Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Welcome to New Books in Medicine on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Monique Dufour. Thanks for listening. My interview with Matthew Heaton about his new book, Black Skin, White Coats, Nigerian Psychiatrists, Decolonization, and the Globalization of Psychiatry, made me think yet again that the history of medicine is by no means only medical. Now, in a lot of ways, that's not surprising, right? Because what it means to be sick or to be well, what it means to cure someone or to go through the process of healing, these are fundamental questions about what it means to be human, and they cut to our visions of the good life. But more than that, I think that Matt's book helps us to see that in order to understand and to narrate questions about the history and the culture of medicine require us to deeply contextualize those experiences. So to tell the story that he does in Black Skin, White Coats, Matt relies on and displays his understanding of African history, of post-colonialism, of globalization, cross-cultural contact, of the history of science and scientific networks. I could go on, but I don't want to intimidate the listeners. This is not a heavy book in any way, and I think that speaks to not only Matt's knowledge, but his craft as a writer, because he weaves these things together in the story in a way that's integral to the story that he tells and makes contributions to multiple disciplines, but does so in a voice and in a narrative that's accessible to us as readers. We at New Books in Medicine and at the New Books Network choose books that we admire and that we like. And so I don't know why I'm surprised consistently when the authors that I interview turn out to be such magnificent talkers as well. But yet again, Matt Heaton comes through, and I think that you'll enjoy listening to him talk about this wonderful book as well. Finally, I wanted to mention that this book is published by Ohio University Press in their really excellent series, The New African Histories. And it's so nice to see academic presses like this one making books available in paperback to we readers who want access to scholarly books and want to own them for ourselves. And it's nice that they're affordable and accessible. So if you enjoy his interview, I really do encourage you to go out and get a copy for yourself, because this book is well worth a read. I hope you enjoy our interview. Welcome to New Books in Medicine on the New Books Network. I'm Monique Dufour. Our guest today is Matthew Heaton, Associate Professor of History at Virginia Tech. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks very much for having me.
Matt's book, Black Skin, White Coats, Nigerian Psychiatrists, Decolonization, and the Globalization of Psychiatry, was published in 2013 by Ohio University Press. It's part of its excellent book series, New African History. Black Skin, White Coats is available in paperback. Matt, to get us started and to help our listeners get acquainted with you, could you talk a little bit about how you would describe your scholarly areas of work as a historian and as a writer?
Yeah, sure. I'm trained in African history. That's the program I went through as a PhD student at the University of Texas. So my general area of interest from the beginning has always been focusing on African agents, African responses, African actions, both in local and in global environments. So I really come at these issues of health, illness, disease, psychiatry, from the perspective of someone who's trained more from an Africanist area studies history program than from a history of medicine in the sort of traditional sense. But I think that the background in African history allows for really interesting new perspectives on the history of health, illness, and medicine by incorporating these African agents into these broader narratives about those issues. And as the title of the book indicates, I'm also interested in broader notions of what it means to have a global history, or what it means to think about a history of globalization. And so this work is really indicative of my interest in making sure that we insert in more equitable ways a broad-based perspective on global actors as well. These Nigerian psychiatrists that I'm talking about in this book were certainly working in Nigeria, but the ideas that they're talking about, the networks that they're working in, certainly expand beyond Nigeria to be more influential at a sort of global level. And so that's really what my interest is as a historian. How do we take African history, make it more relevant to people who are interested in history outside of Africa? How do we globalize African history? And I think that the history of health, disease, and medicine is a very important field through which we can start to have these conversations to be more incorporative and more equitable in where the sort of meta-narratives come from.
We'll talk more in detail about the book in a few minutes, but I'm wondering, this is a lot to learn in order to develop a project like this that has so many dimensions. How did you develop your interests and expertise in this area, and how did you get to looking at African history in connection to medicine itself?
Well, I had started out, not really knowing what my research interest was going to be, other than that I was interested in African history and specifically history of Nigeria, which developed sort of more circumstantially, serendipitously through the relationships that I made early in my graduate training. When I first went to Nigeria for field work, I had actually intended to write something on the history of witchcraft. And for a variety of reasons, that research wasn't going as smoothly as I had hoped it would go. Mm-hmm. But I found these case files in the Nigerian National Archives in Ibadan that dealt with the repatriation of Nigerian mental patients during the colonial period. And I immediately knew that this was something that had a potential to provide a fresh story. We don't really think or talk a lot about people who travel out of Africa in sort of the post-slave trade era, frankly. So I knew that there was an angle there. And because I had been interested in these issues of witchcraft and generally histories of medicine, I knew that, you know, there was a way to talk about the psychology behind the repatriation files that we'll talk about more later, through engaging with that history of medicine stream in Africanist history.
Would you say that your project kind of found you? I mean, I think that I hear I hear this so many times where we work with our students as they're working on dissertations and they think the topics arrive fully formed, but it's definitely a process of evolution as you're kind of explaining.
Oh, absolutely. Right. And frankly, people that I consider my generation of scholars and my friends and colleagues You know, that seems to be the more common story, frankly. By the time, you know, you've done this for several years, you know, you have an idea, you have to be able to articulate something for the purposes of funding proposals and those types of things. But, you know, getting into the field and really finding the sources that you're going to work with and getting the sort of nuanced perspective on these things, that's where you're going to end up making the contribution ultimately. And that's all in a lot of ways that, you know, that's about putting yourself in a position to allow the new interesting thing to happen, right? I totally agree. The project found me and it partly found me through a willingness to be open to ideas that were different than the ones that I had, you know, sort of pigeonholed myself into looking for, you know, initially.
Since this book came from a dissertation, what did you learn in the process about taking a dissertation to a book?
And that's a really good question. I think, you know, there are different layers and levels of approaching that. One is sort of the notion of, you know, what should a book be trying to accomplish versus what a dissertation is trying to accomplish. And I think that, you know, the dissertation was trying to please five very specific people, obviously, and to illustrate a competency in the disciplinary background, et cetera. But I think a book obviously should be doing something a little bit different than that. It should be trying to reach a slightly broader audience at the very least. You know, making some arguments that help to move a field forward, at least as much, if not more so, than sort of indicating the individual author's competencies. And so that was one of the things that I knew immediately that I wanted to do with this manuscript. As I said, the dissertation was just about these repatriated Nigerian mental patients. That was pretty narrow mm-hmm. when it came down to it for a dissertation, and it didn't seem like something really that in and of itself, much more than the five people on my dissertation mm-hmm. committee were probably going to be very interested in reading that. And so it partly becomes a calculus of figuring out how can you write something that's more marketable and that does more useful things for more people. But of course, the second part of that, of course, is that the dissertation raises a whole host of other questions that you don't necessarily have the time or the resources to address in the process of trying to write a dissertation and complete a degree and move on with a career. So the having the sort of, in some ways, flexibility to turn a dissertation into a manuscript was sort of liberating. Also, of course, being on the timetable of doing this in a tenure track position is a little bit daunting, but at the same time, it did allow me to address some of the more significant, broader issues that I thought the repatriation of Nigerian mental patients raised, including, you know, what is happening in the way that not just psychiatrists in Nigeria or Africa, but more globally, are thinking about the relationship between issues of culture and migration and the notions of psychological normality, whatever that is.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think I should tell our listeners that Matt really succeeds in broadening the audience for his dissertation topic to more than five people. I was right from the start very engaged by your book. And to dive into it, you begin the book in 1961 with the story of the first Pan-African psychiatric conference in Nigeria. I was immediately hooked. Can you tell me a little bit about this story and why you begin the book with it?
Yeah, so the first Pan-African psychiatric conference takes place in November of 1961 in and around Abeokuta in Nigeria, southwestern Nigeria. And what happens at this conference is that a large number, several dozen psychiatric experts from Nigeria, from Africa more broadly, and from around the world come together in this place to hold a conference where they're really talking about, you know, what's happening to the way that we think about these relationships that I just mentioned between notions of race and culture, psychological normality, as it were, and causes and consequences of mental illness. And I started the book with this because I really saw this conference as being very much a microcosm for what's happening in psychiatric discourses more broadly at this time. The members of this conference include Thomas Lambeau, who I'm sure we're going to talk about mm-hmm. at great length going forward here, who's the first Nigerian to earn a medical specialty in psychiatry and begin practicing in the late 1950s in Nigeria. But it also included other African psychiatrists, of which there were a few at the time, included J.C. Carruthers, a sort of infamous colonial psychiatrist who had propagated many of the sort of more heinous ideas about the relationship between a race and sort of African inferiority, psychological inferiority in the colonial context. And it also included some burgeoning transcultural psychiatrists from Europe and the United States, guys like Alexander Layton, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were talking about is, you know, we need to figure out a way to change the way we talk about these relationships between race, culture, and mental illness. And what these people are really talking about is moving towards a more universalistic model where we don't see race and culture necessarily as innately making people innately psychologically different, but talking about people as being innately psychologically the same. This is happening at the conference. But I think it's really instructive that this is happening in 1961, right? Because 1961, this is 1 year after Nigeria becomes an independent country. It's broken away from the British Empire. Many, many other countries in Africa and Asia have done so or are doing so at this exact moment. So the geopolitical landscape is changing pretty significantly. And those changes in the geopolitical landscape, I argue, are sort of making it possible or certainly contributing to the context within which other types of hierarchical understandings of humanity are being reshaped. And the conference really indicates how these things are happening, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you start here in 1961. Could you just give us a little preview about the larger narrative arc of the story, just maybe the chronology that you cover and the general sweep of it?
In the entire book?
Yeah, or, just so yeah. Our listeners can get a sense of the whole as we start to get into the more specific.
Yeah, so the book really covers mostly the 20th century, from the first decade of the 20th century up until, I think, the latest stuff I talk about at any point is really in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Getting more recent than that becomes ever more tricky, right, for historians. So what I start with is sort of a basic framework understanding of what colonial psychiatry is doing. And I know that that's, you know, only one place that you could start talking about histories of psychiatry in sort of either African context or global context. So I start with the colonial context for a couple of reasons here. One of them is because I think this is really a game-changing moment in terms of how the world is politically oriented, and it has pretty significant consequences for the capacity of something like a psychiatric discourse to spread around the world. So it's at this time that we start to see many European psychiatrists and armchair psychiatrists talking about how people relate to each other psychologically. What are the sort of hierarchies? Should there be hierarchies? Of course, Europeans decide there should be at this time. But there's also practical implications behind it too, because as European powers start to colonize parts of Africa and Asia, they then also become sort of responsible for practicing psychiatry in these places to a very minimal extent. And so one of the discourses that emerges is basically how much psychiatry should be operational in European colonies. Ultimately, they decide very little for ideological reasons that we can get into later. So I think that that's one important thing, right? Because the colonial context creates a space within which these more universal discussions about the nature of human psychology are happening. The second thing that I think is really important about the colonial context for how the book flows out is that so many of the psychiatrists in Nigeria that I'm talking about from the 50s, 60s, 70s on, you know, they're not operating in a bubble. They are products of historical contexts and legacies themselves. And much of what they're talking about is, in fact, kind of a counter narrative or a counter argument to the preceding knowledge about African psychology that had been created largely in those colonial political and ideological constructs. So I start there in the first chapter. We then move into the 1950s with the founding of Aro Hospital in southwestern Nigeria and Thomas Lambo, the first Nigerian psychiatrist, taking up the reins of that first modern mental hospital in Nigeria in the 1950s. And talk about the ways that he is I don't know if radically is the right word, but certainly more energetically transforming the way psychiatry is being practiced in Nigeria at this time. He's combating a lot of the sort of racist underlying notions within colonial psychiatry. And he's also embarking on a much more hands-on, incorporative clinical practice in Nigeria as well, far over and above what had ever previously existed in the earlier colonial period. So that sort of sets up a broad historical framework. The next part of the book then goes into some case studies where we talk about the repatriation of Nigerian mental patients, to talk about some specific psychiatric disorders and how their understandings change pretty significantly over time, schizophrenia, depression, and what's called brain fag syndrome. There's an entire chapter then where we talk about the relationship of Nigerian psychiatrists to traditional healers, right? Mm-hmm. Those sort of local authorities on psychological normality and abnormality in Nigeria, even till today. Mm-hmm. And then the last chapter deals with what happens in the context of the development of psychopharmaceutical drugs that are at least purported to have sort of universal implications for how psychiatry is treated as a biological phenomenon, mm-hmm. right? Largely from the 1950s. And this is the material that goes more into the 1980s at the end of the book. Mm-hmm.
So let's start talking a little bit more about the setup. You start with the colonial institutions and networks of what you call ethno-psychotherapy. Why do you use that word, by the way, ethno-psychotherapy?
It's a word that's used at the time, mm-hmm. To describe the ways that Europeans are seeing psychology and psychiatry in cultural contexts, right? The question is, as I say in the first chapter, they're not really questioning whether culture and race have an effect on people's psychology. They're coming at it from the perspective of course it does. Why and how, mm-hmm. right? Why do Africans appear psychologically the way we perceive them to be, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a term that's used at the time to describe that. At the same time, it's a little bit complicated because what's meant by ethnopsychiatry really in the African context largely breaks down to a racial binary, right? The ethno essentially means African, right? So there's not a whole lot of work that's being done to compare, say, Maasai with Yoruba or Zulu with with Luo or whatever you want to, whatever ethnic markers you want to use. When they say ethnopsychiatry, what they really mean is, you know, this sort of lumped together Africanness, which is distinguishable primarily by its perceived differences from a lumped together Europeanness or whiteness or whatever else.
So I want to turn to chapter two, and maybe we can go back to chapter one a little bit to mm-hmm. build a little bit of context. But you turn to the period of decolonizing psychiatric institutions, and you tell the story primarily through the central figure of Thomas Lambeau. Mm-hmm. Could you say a little bit about how Lambeau's story helps us to understand this process in the 1950s and 60s?
Yeah, Lambeau's an extremely interesting and important figure for the history of psychiatry in Nigeria and Africa generally, and I would argue in important ways globally, right? I mean, he has an impact outside of Nigeria and Africa, certainly. So Thomas Lambeau, as I've mentioned a couple of times already, is the first Nigerian person to earn a medical specialty in psychiatry. He was raised in Abeokuta in southwestern Nigeria. He went to missionary schools in this area, matriculated on to university at Birmingham in the UK, did a medical specialty there, and then did a psychiatric specialty at the Maudsley Hospital in London before coming back in 1954 to take over the reins of the first modern mental hospital in Nigeria called Aro Mental Hospital. Which was created right about the same time, 1954. In fact, at the time that Lambeau became the medical superintendent of Aro Hospital, it wasn't even completely built yet. So he was sort of overseeing the completion of the facility itself at the same time that he was starting to undertake clinical practice there. Lambeau is an important figure because he represents, in a lot of ways, the the transitions that are happening in the 1950s and 1960s. They go back older than this, but Lambeau is certainly a member of this European educated elite in Nigeria. It goes back a long time. You know, sort of West African cosmopolitanism is a longstanding stream. But in the 1940s and 1950s, it has significant political implications in the processes of decolonization and transferring independence. So Lambeau becomes a psychiatrist who's working in Nigeria, and in the process of working in Nigeria, he's doing things, right, that the colonial government never even really considered doing, mm-hmm. actually providing sort of modern psychiatric practice. And in so doing, he's able to make a couple of really important points. One is colonial psychiatry got a lot of things very wrong about Africans, and particularly Nigerians, from his perspective, partly because they weren't particularly invested in practicing psychiatry in this region. So that led to all kinds of wrong assumptions, very bad science in his perspective. At the same time, he's also very much illustrating what the value of indigenous leadership is in the context of decolonization and independence. He's proving that, one, of course, Africans are not intellectually, psychologically, professionally inferior to Europeans. He's practicing on the highest levels, right? What is the point of colonialism if we have Africans who can do these things? And as he's illustrating, do them better than the colonial governments themselves had. So he becomes sort of not just a scientific medical figure. He is a political figure in a lot of ways in Nigeria. He is an example of the good things that are coming out of decolonization and independence for Nigeria, right? And he was very conscious of this, very conscious of this. Worked alongside politicians at the first Pan-African Psychiatric Conference that we talked about earlier, right? Yeah, so he had deliberately invited a number of important politicians to the first Pan-African Psychiatric Conference, maybe most notably the Prime Minister of the Federation of Nigeria, Cyril Haji Tafawa Balewa, made an appearance at this conference. So Lambeau knew these people. He was involved with these people. They certainly saw him as an asset in sort of the First Republic government in the 1960s. And he went on to have a very long distinguished career in global public health. He had ultimately left Aro in the late 60s to become the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Ibadan, a university that had been founded in the late 40s as the first degree-granting institution in Nigeria, and which continued to grow over the 50s and 60s during the decolonization process. He was later the vice chancellor of that university before he went on to basically a second career in global public health at the World Health Organization, where he ultimately became a deputy director general throughout most of the 70s and 80s. Mm. So he was a very important figure for sort of representing this transformation of psychiatric practice in Nigeria, in Africa, and to a certain extent the world during this era.
Mm-hmm. And this kind of brings me to a more conceptual question before we go to the cases that you take up in the book. Mm-hmm. The relationship between the local and the global is just central to this book, and it's something that you are so careful about navigating. And in what ways is this book specific to Nigeria? And in what ways can it be said that it is representative of more widespread issues and changes? Like, what should or shouldn't we extrapolate, and what is incumbent upon us in this story to attend to the local, and why?
Yeah, this is a huge question. Okay, yeah. This might be one of the ones where I go for 10 or 12 minutes.
It seems so important to the way you conceived of the book.
Yeah. What should we or shouldn't we extrapolate from the relationship between the local and the global? And I think I would throw the universal into that, uh-huh. right, to the extent that the universal is supposed to have a global implication. Mm-hmm. I think what we shouldn't extrapolate is the notion – well, I'm going to say several things that we shouldn't extrapolate. But one of the things we shouldn't extrapolate is that guys like Lambeau, Asuni, and other psychiatrists who are working in this new transcultural framework of trying to understand psychological normality as a universal process, we shouldn't assume that they got it right. I think that this is, and one of the things, like you say, that I'm careful about in this book is trying to locate that discourse within its historical, political and social context, right? This is an argument that gets made in the 50s and 60s because it's a very attractive argument at this time, right? It's overcoming what are perceived as clear inadequacies in the scholarship and the medicine that has come before this. It is addressing a new world order that is presumably not going to be based on sort of racial and cultural hierarchies that had preceded its very attractive model. And it does do some good things, but it doesn't explain everything, right? Ultimately, at the end of the day, there are a lot of sort of blurred edges, frayed edges, where notions of culture and individuality and social relations, all of these things, the differences of them across space still have pretty significant salient meaning for a lot of people. And this is where the book sort of ends in the 70s and 80s, talking about how this universalistic model gets very frayed and battered about the edges to the extent that it's not entirely accepted the way it was in the 50s and 60s. One thing, though, that I do think we absolutely should extrapolate. Wow, I said absolutely. I don't know, but we should extrapolate from this is the extent to which psychiatry does become a sort of global enterprise in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And when we say it becomes a global enterprise, I think we need to be careful in not ascribing the global to the Western, right? That psychiatry in the 50s, 60s, and 70s is not the sort of Basala model of development of scientific knowledge in a particular space, and it's spreading out to the rest of the world, a sort of unipolar thing or something, right? What is happening is that knowledge and information is coming from a whole variety of different places, and it's circulating in extraordinarily complex ways, and that a lot of the places this knowledge is coming from is from sort of non-Western environments, places like Nigeria, places like, if we'll talk about the IPSS in a few minutes, but right, the information for the International Pilot Study of Schizophrenia is coming from around the world, literally around the world. And so to ascribe the sort of binary model of Western science spreading out to the rest of the world is reductive, right, at best. What we see here are people from around the world grappling with sort of the basic notions of Western science, but transforming them pretty significantly, and then creating a feedback loop into the rest of the world, where that new knowledge is then transforming the way that people in other parts of the world are seeing those older concepts. That's happening in Nigeria, and that's happening in a lot of other places at this time, right? Lambo is not the only psychiatrist practicing in Africa. He's not the only one practicing in the non-West, right? These same types of decolonizing practices are occurring in India. I've done a little bit of research on that throughout Southeast Asia, in Latin America, and of course in a variety of different socioeconomic groups within Western countries as well, right? So that we're getting a much more comprehensive perspective on how people actually think and behave, and that is actually affecting some of the core baseline concepts of the discipline itself.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, speaking of how ideas move along with people, let's turn to Chapter 3. And what I'd like to ask you is, what are some of the international dimensions of decolonizing psychiatry that you explore through the experiences of Nigerians who migrated to the UK since the 1950s?
Yeah, so Chapter 3, as I mentioned, this is the one that sort of grew out of the dissertation. It's actually a much smaller sort of condensing of my dissertation. And what's interesting about this chapter, I think, that really has informed the way the entire book came together, is this notion that we can't treat the history of psychiatry as the sort of transition from an imperial psychiatry to a bunch of different little national psychiatries, right? This is one of the things that, for example, Warwick Anderson has talked about as being sort of problematic in the history of medicine, that we allow it to follow this sort of teleological narrative of the sort of emergence of the nation state, and then we just tell these confined national medical histories, right? And this is an example of how that becomes problematic, right? Because what do you do with the people who are crossing those national boundaries? What do you do when you have to bring to bear knowledge of people who are coming from different places, who exist in a variety of different places, and can't necessarily fit those national molds? And so this is what's happening with these Nigerians, particularly in the 50s and 60s, who are going abroad and developmental illnesses. So what the chapter argues is that you see these, I have dozens and dozens of cases of these of Nigerians who went abroad mostly for study, right? They're going to the UK or maybe Canada, a couple to the US, mostly to study at this time, because as we've talked about, there's not a whole lot of opportunity for higher education in West Africa in the 50s and 60s. So they go abroad. They have psychological issues while they're abroad. And then the question becomes, well, what do you do with people when they have a mental breakdown outside of their sort of local environment? There's a lot of ways that you could approach this question, right? First is, you know, why are they having these psychological problems? Is it a sort of an innate function of their personality that they brought with them when they traveled? Is it the result of social pressures and problems in the sort of place of destination? Is it some combination of these things? These are very difficult things to tease out. So what the chapter does is look at how these questions were addressed by different groups in the 50s and 60s. And what it largely argues is that most of these cases that I have files for, the reason I have files for them is because they were proposed for repatriation, and so their file then became public record in Nigeria. So it's not a comprehensive list necessarily of every Nigerian who ever suffered a psychological problem in the UK or anywhere else, right? But these cases, they were proposed for repatriation, and if you read through the files, you look at what the explanations were for repatriation. So it might be intuitive to think that this would all be about issues of citizenship and who has legal right to exist in a particular space. But throughout most of this period, you know, Nigerians have a right of residency in the UK and really anywhere else in the British Empire. It's not a matter of immigration. It's a matter of immigration in the United States for the few people who are flown back from there. But mostly, these Nigerians have total right of residency in the United Kingdom. You can't just repatriate them because they're not British. In legal terms, they actually are. So what's perpetuating this repatriation problem, right? It's really centrally conceived around what's supposed to be in the medical best interests of these patients. And so the case files repeatedly make claims that it would be in the patient's best interest to be returned home. And underlying that are a whole host of arguments about racial and cultural difference, right? And the primary one being that these Nigerians, because they come from West Africa, which is perceived in the 50s to be a more primitive culture, right, a more backwards place. These people are from cultures that are sort of simple and not very sophisticated. When those folks go to a place like the United Kingdom, right, then they just can't handle it, right? And so the sort of hyper-modernity of the UK is overwhelming to them. Trying to actually earn a degree in the sort of Western education sense is extra difficult for Africans who have a sort of psychological and intellectual inferiority within sort of racist colonial discourses. So returning them home is seen to be as the only likely way that they're going to get better, mm-hmm. right? They have to go back to a culture that they're familiar with, that they understand, and that they can function within, right? So that's what many of these case files say. And this became a problem in the 50s and early 60s. Newspaper reports of this happening and how this is sort of indicative of crises of modernity and decolonization and what's going on with these West Africans. So Lambeau actually takes up this issue in the late 50s, and he wrote a report on these repatriation problems, and he comes to a pretty different conclusion, right? He's not denying that many Nigerians go abroad, particularly to the UK, and suffer psychological breakdowns. He has a very different answer for why that's happening, right? And so from his perspective, there's a whole host of social stressors that are particular to Nigerian migrants in the UK that don't have anything particularly to do with their cultural background, but have to do with the position of Nigeria within sort of this colonial post-imperial context and the globalizing world that these Nigerians are trying to work within. So he points out things like experiences of racism that Nigerians have in the UK. He points out things like extreme poverty that Nigerian immigrants are facing in the UK. You know, the financing of these degrees can be very, very difficult and stressful for people. He points to the extraordinary pressures on Nigerian students to succeed, right? They're often the only person in their family going to school. This is not just about their individual success. It's about the long-term sort of social climbing of their family, right? And so Lambeau comes to a very different conclusion about the value of repatriation. He says if you're really concerned about the mental health of these patients, they need to be well-treated in the UK. There needs to be significantly increased communication between the UK and Nigeria. There needs to be training for students about what to expect when they go to the UK. There needs to be sort of he even makes the argument, right, that sort of media representing Africa as sort of tribal and backwards and all these things needs to be limited because that's contributing to the way that Britons treat Nigerian immigrants, etc. So it becomes a much broader social issue in a very transnational context for Lambeau. Again, sort of representing this transition from a colonial psychiatry of marginalized Africans to a perceived change in the geopolitical order in which Africans are going to be play a much bigger role. Right.
Mm-hmm. So let's turn to chapter four. So how did Nigerian psychiatrists confront and engage with culture-bound diagnoses and disease categories?
Yeah, this is a good question, and this is another one where the history sort of matters because it kind of changes over mm-hmm. time, and depending on what the sort of value of particular explanations are at a given time. So the chapter four discusses the sort of three different psychological disorders, two of which are presumed to be more or less universal, depression and schizophrenia, and then this third one called brain fag syndrome, which is, as you're suggesting, is deemed to be culture bound, at least in the 60s, mm-hmm. to Nigeria. And so, as I've mentioned before, right, many of these psychiatrists, Lambeau and others working from the 50s and 60s, these transcultural psychiatrists, are much more interested in the notion that psychological disorder is a sort of universal set of categories. But it's also at this time that you get discourses about culture-bound syndromes coming mostly not actually out of Africa, mostly out of North America and Southeast Asia. Disorders like amok, for example, which has been recognized for a long time, gets classified as a culture-bound disorder to Southeast Asia. Things like koro, which are represented as sort of a pathological fear that the genitals are being sucked into the body and that it will kill you, ghost sickness in North America. These types of cultural explanations for mental illness that seem to themselves be the cause of the mental illness. Mm-hmm. So brain fag syndrome becomes one of these, and brain fag syndrome is identified first by Raymond Prince, who's a Canadian psychiatrist. He came to Nigeria in the late 50s specifically to work with Tom Lambeau and to look at the sort of relationship between culture and psychopathology. That's what he was there to do as a transcultural psychiatrist. And he starts to identify what he comes to call brain fag. He actually didn't coin it. The students who came to him coined it. But what brain fag is characterized by is particularly students were the subject population that Prince identified. They would come and say, look, I can't think straight. I can't read anymore. I can't function normally. I'm having all these weird somatic sensations, burning and tingling in my head up and down my arms. It's driving me crazy. I think something's really wrong with me. This became called brain fag, short for brain fatigue. And the notion that Prince came up with was that this was being caused primarily by this transition that Nigeria was experiencing from sort of colonial backwater to modernizing independent or moving towards independence anyway at this time state. And he ultimately argued that brain fag was essentially being caused by a conflict between what he called the Nigerian personality and the modernizing processes of a decolonizing independent Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, this is what's causing this because Nigerians are sort of not culturally suited for the types of educational endeavors that they're undertaking. That's what Prince, the Canadian psychiatrist, said. Now, I've never found anything from Lambeau or Asuni, you know, the very first generation of Nigerian psychiatrists who worked closely with Prince, actually, saying anything particularly about brain fag. But by the 1970s, there are significant critiques of the brain fag etiology coming out from Nigerian psychiatrists who are arguing that there's nothing that really indicates that brain fag is culturally bound in any way whatsoever, right? So there are articles written basically indicating that there's no way to identify a Nigerian personality as distinct from any other group's personality using any sort of personality indicators that have scientific merit, right? There are studies saying, you know, Prince identified these symptoms to subgroups of student populations, but you actually see these symptoms in all kinds of other non-student populations as well. He just doesn't call it brain fag when it happens in non-students. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of studies that say we see these symptoms, the symptom cluster, in people kind of all over the world, right, in other parts of Africa. There have been studies about, you know, brain fag in Papua New Guinea, and largely Nigerian psychiatrists have been pretty critical of the notion that there is a culture-bound entity called brain fag syndrome. That said, brain fag syndrome was used in the DSM-4 as a discrete culture-bound disorder in the glossary on culture-bound disorders. It's been removed in DSM-5, which has a very different structure for how it indicates cultural expressions of psychological disorder. But that's the story on brain fag. Now, that said, by the 80s, you are starting to see some Nigerian psychiatrists who are kind of critiquing the notion that there are these universal disorders, or at least that the universal disorders that we use are the appropriate, you know, units of psychological disorder. So in the conclusion of the book, I talk about Roger Macanjuola's work on Odeori, which is a culturally distinct disease entity to the Yoruba people of southwestern Nigeria. Odeori translates to hunter of the head, right? And it's a longstanding, you know, psychological disorder in among the Yoruba people in Nigeria that's characterized in a lot of ways by similar symptoms, right? Ringing sensation in the ears, somatic crawling sensations in the body, difficulty thinking, sort of fuzzy headedness, insomnia, these types of issues. The explanatory factor for Odeori in Yoruba, in the Yoruba worldview, is that it's caused by a worm that enters into your body, most likely through the ear, and then it just sort of crawls around inside your body. And that can be naturally occurring, or it could be sort of placed there through witchcraft machinations, other things like that. But so Macanjuola did a study in the 80s where he took a bunch of different people who were easily identified as having Odeori by traditional healers in Yoruba land, and took them to, well, they were actually already patients in a psychiatric hospital at Ife, and he got their diagnosis from the psychiatric hospital. 30 patients easily identifiable as Odeori in Yoruba context got, I can't remember the exact number, 10 or 11 different diagnoses in the psychiatric hospital, ranging from like paranoid schizophrenia down to just, you know, mild cases of depression or something to that effect. Now, when these patients were treated in the psychiatric hospital, Macanjuola found that some of the symptoms went away, particularly symptoms associated with the disorder that they were diagnosed with in the psychiatric hospital. So some hallucinations would go away if they were sort of hallucinatory schizophrenics or whatever psychological symptoms. But a lot of the somatic complaints, the itching and the burning and the vision symptoms, things like this, they didn't go away with psychotherapeutic treatments in the psychiatric hospital. And so Macanjuola concluded, you know, I think a little tongue-in-cheek, of course, but the idea being that, you know, we fall back on the notion that schizophrenia and depression are the universal disorders. Who's to say that Odeori is not the universal disorder that gets identified as schizophrenia or depression or all these other things in different cultural contexts? So, and that's a product of a later time period, where, as mentioned earlier, the sort of the edges of the universal model are kind of fraying for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, in chapter 5, you turn to the way that universal model and all of the other things that Nigerian psychiatrists took with them and brought into Nigeria in the mid-century encountered so-called traditional healers and the context in which And so I'm wondering how Nigerian psychiatrists fashioned themselves in their work in relationship to these so-called traditional healers and the context in which they simultaneously worked.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very complicated question, right? Mm-hmm. As you're suggesting, that chapter is dealing with the ways that Nigerian psychiatrists positioned themselves vis-a-vis traditional healers. And I think one of the really important things to point out at the outset here is in two things. One is calling anyone a traditional healer is a little mm-hmm. a little bit of a, you know, a strange way to do this, because it implies that there are non-traditional healers or something. I mean, Western psychiatrists are coming from a tradition the same way that mm-hmm. the healers in Nigeria are coming from a tradition, right? It's just that in the context of Nigeria from the 1950s on, the traditions that indigenous healers are using are locally tried and true, right? They're locally respected. They have legitimacy because they've worked there for a long time for people. The practices that the Western trained psychiatrists are bringing in aren't necessarily as culturally translatable. They are seen as the sort of outside alien way of doing things. And this is, you know, this is problematic in any sort of scientific or medical endeavor, right? But it's particularly problematic for something like psychiatry, where cultural cultural buy-in is really important, right? Where it's well recognized that the relationship between the therapist and the patient really kind of needs to be one of trust, right? In order for this to work very well. And sort of the way the Western trained psychiatrists think about it. So what they're dealing with really is the clear understanding that if they're actually going to try to provide effective psychotherapeutic care for Nigerians in a way that had not been attempted really under the colonial regime, they're going to have to figure out a way to make the methods that they believe in, that they have studied, that they think are effectual, they have to find a way to get Nigerians to buy into it with them, right? Either through explaining what they do in local cultural terms that are appropriate, mm-hmm. or through bringing in some of the indigenous ideas into the way that they practice their sort of Western-trained psychiatry. And they go about this in a number of ways. Lambeau may have been among the most optimistic about the possibilities for Western-trained psychiatrists and indigenous healers, traditional healers, to work together. At RO Hospital, where he had sort of been the founding medical superintendent, he had promoted what was called the RO Village Scheme, which was a project whereby Nigerians would come to the hospital, but instead of getting inpatient treatment, right, where they had a bed in a large ward or whatever, if you think once over the cuckoo's nest or something like that, it was a very different model. He had Nigerian patients living in a local village nearby the hospital. They would pay rent to live in the homes of villagers. They would maybe get some therapy at the hospital during the day, but mostly the therapeutic experience was about living in the village environment, monitored, right, and sort of controlled. But the idea was try and replicate some sort of normalcy for these patients. This is one of the first things that Lambeau did that got him international renown, was to sort of set up this village scheme. He wasn't the first to do this type of thing, but he got a lot of attention for it. Now, part of that process of having a sort of normalized village scheme system would be to provide the type of healing that patients there expected. And so that meant bringing in indigenous healers, right, to work with the patients, because that's what patients thought they needed. That's what they felt was going to make them better. So he worked with indigenous healers in this village setting. He thought it was therapeutic for the patients, and he also thought that through observation and communication with indigenous healers, there could be a better interaction between himself and indigenous healers. He could learn things that could then be used to provide better Western-based psychiatric care. And so he was very optimistic about that. Others were not quite so optimistic, right? So Talani Asuni, who was the second Nigerian to get a psychiatric specialty from Dublin, and he came back and worked with Lambeau, took over RO Hospital when Lambeau went to the University of Ibadan, very renowned psychiatrist in his own right. He was much more critical of the practices of traditional healers and the capacity for them to be incorporated into a sort of orthodox psychiatric framework. He was very concerned about some practices by traditional healers that he thought violated medical ethics that he learned, things like chaining people up to logs or using medicinal treatments without any kind of dosage or regimen, things like this that could be very dangerous for patients in his view. And so he argued that's pretty problematic. He also argued, right, that it would be really difficult to integrate these two things because basically, from his perspective, the Western-trained psychiatrists were going to have to be primus inter pares, right? So Asuni thought that the Western-trained psychiatrists were ultimately going to have to be the ones sort of in the sort of paternalistic position here of being the gatekeeper, as the chapter's called, gatekeepers of the mind, mm-hmm. of making decisions about what knowledge is good and what knowledge is not good, what practices are ethical and appropriate and which ones aren't. And he argued, first of all, that Western-trained psychiatrists should do this, right, because it's part of their training and ethics to do it, and he absolutely believed it was the right thing to do. But he also argued, right, that if you engage in that relationship, you're pretty significantly changing what the traditional healing process is. You're changing maybe the practices that they're able to engage in, and you're certainly changing the way that that group of people is perceived as legitimate and sort of sovereign in their knowledge, right? And that could have really damaging implications for their efficacy going forward in terms of gaining trust and being able to be effective. So he was very much more of the mindset that these two systems, they might both need to exist. In some ways, they would be complementary, but the idea that they would be integrated at any point in the future didn't seem particularly likely to him. And in a lot of ways, that's a conflict that continues to be played out, not just in Nigeria, but in all over the world, right? Between sort of orthodox Western derived psychiatric techniques and more folk medicine practices. Mm-hmm.
Turning to chapter 6, the title is kind of self-explanatory, and I'm going to frame my question right along those lines. You call it The Paradoxes of Psychoactive Drugs. So would you like to tell our listeners a few of the paradoxes that you identify and why they arise?
Yeah, so there are paradoxes in a couple of different ways, right? I call it a paradox largely because what you have here is, in the context of psychopharmaceutical drugs that are developed to treat major mental illnesses, you have an underlying notion that these have the capacity to be sort of universal, right? They're drugs. They affect the body, mm-hmm. right, in a way the psychiatry hadn't previously really been able to entirely buy into, right? From the perspective of Western-trained psychiatrists, these psychopharmaceuticals, by which I mean drugs to treat major mental illnesses like schizophrenia, and particularly in depression a little bit later, anxiety symptoms, right? They create the context to really sort of illustrate the sort of universal underlying similarity of these conditions, right? Because these drugs should work everywhere at the same time. At the same time, these drugs become really complicated to administer in the context of Nigeria. They've been complicated everywhere to administer. So we get in the context of Nigeria drugs that Nigerian psychiatrists argue have been really, really useful and beneficial for treating mental illnesses, but only in very specific ways. So there's major concern from the 40s and 50s, right, that there's not much of a drug culture historically in Nigeria other than sort of alcoholic beverages in the south. At the same time that psychopharmaceuticals are entering the markets, you're also seeing an increase in all kinds of other illicit drugs that are coming in from around the world, marijuana, for example, amphetamines, even harder drugs, cocaine derivatives and heroin and all these types of things later on. And so the concern is, right, which drugs are good and which ones are bad and what makes drugs good and what makes them bad. So many Nigerian psychiatrists are sort of arguing on the one hand that these drugs can be really useful for treating mental illnesses, right, if they're administered by doctors. They also argue that sometimes people are using these drugs, sort of personally to self-medicate, to deal with problems that they're dealing with in their own lives, right, that are caused by the transitions that Nigeria is undertaking, that partly allow for things like psychiatric care and treatment with drugs. Mm-hmm. There are also paradoxes in the sense that that the drugs don't necessarily always work the way universally that they're supposed to, right? There have been lots of studies over more recent times of sort of differences in metabolic rates and all these other things can affect the ways that drugs affect individual bodies. And one of the critiques that comes out is that the sort of clinical studies for psychopharmaceuticals still overwhelmingly take place amongst sort of Western populations, not amongst Africans, and that can affect the way that those drugs work on Africans. A third paradox is that these drugs do provide the possibility for treating mental patients, but over time they become sort of the baseline fallback option for treating patients. And so you start to see a lot of Nigerian psychiatrists, particularly from the 80s, after the economy sort of declines and the state sort of takes a step back from sort of expanding these types of social programs, that the only thing that psychiatrists can really do is give people drugs because they don't have the resources, the staff, anything to do what they would consider to be potentially much more productive psychotherapeutic processes, right? So there are a variety of paradoxes there that make the drug situation sort of a double-edged sword for how psychiatry operates in Nigeria. And I sort of conclude in that chapter making the point that this is one of the ways that we see the Nigerian case dovetailing with more global responses to psychopharmaceuticals. This is a similar discourse to what we see in the United States, right? At what point are we over prescribing drugs, so as opposed to dealing with social problems in a much more broad-based way?
Mm-hmm. We're just about out of time. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you wanted to tell me about regarding your book?
Oh wow, I wasn't prepared for that question. I can't think of anything particularly.
Well, then why don't you tell me what you're working on now and what's next?
Okay. So what's next is moving a little bit away from the sort of central focus on issues of health, medicine, and psychiatry, but still very much emphasizing this relationship between the global and the local and how Nigerians are fitting into a broader world history. What I'm working on now is a history of Hajj, the Nigerian pilgrimage to Mecca in the 20th century, and ultimately deals with a lot of the same types of issues. We're still dealing with migrant populations over a long period of time and sort of integrating them into broader narratives about this thing that we recognize as being transnational and sort of global for a long period of time, but that I don't think we really always think about Africans as participating in, and certainly not necessarily Nigerians. Although at points in the past, Nigeria has sent one of the largest national contingents to the Hajj throughout much of the 1970s, for example. So what this project is trying to do is look at this question of local and global and how the national plays into it through another different lens here. It's pretty preliminary right now, but the sort of going argument that I have right now is that the Hajj becomes one of these tools by which the national entity of Nigeria sort of tries to legitimize itself, right? So the Hajj recognizes transnational. It's been going on from the area that is Nigeria several hundred years, right? But in the course of the 20th century, it gets very heavily controlled. How people go on Hajj is a matter of governmental importance, and it's a matter of governmental importance not just for Nigeria but for all states. It's heavily regulated on an international level. And so even as the Hajj grows, more and more people going on it every year increasingly have to go with a passport that says they come from a particular country and they're sort of engaged with the sort of nation state as an entity in order to do this thing. And so that's the question that's sort of interesting to me. How does that happen? How does that change over time? What is the sort of tension and complementarity that goes between this transnational process and national processes that are taking place in Africa in the 20th century?
Yeah, that sounds fantastic, and I look forward to reading it. thank you for joining us today on New Books in Medicine. My guest has been Dr. Matthew Heaton. I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too. Thanks so much.
Goodbye.
Bye.